Don't build a business, buy a business. You hear this stuff all the time online. And so is it true? Is it really that easy to just take over $1 million plus business for free? Well, let's dive into it. And I'm going to talk about three different models: $0 down, consulting for equity, and then service for equity. And I have experience with this because I've been on the buy side and the sell side for both these things. And if you don't know who I am, my name is Akshay Mosey. I own Acquisition.com. It's a portfolio of companies that does over $200 million a year. And I make these videos so that you make lots and lots of money so that maybe someday I write you a check for your business too. Big flashing lights. This video is not to tell you to do $0 down or not do $0 down buying of businesses. It's to give you the right tools to know which is right for you right now of the three models I'm going to explain. Now, let's dive in. So, buying a business for $0 down. Now, what people will cite is the fact that there's 10,000 baby boomers a day that are retiring, and they're just giving away their businesses at the end of their lives because their Gen Z kids don't want to be plumbers, don't want to be HVAC people. But if you look a little bit more closely, that's not really entirely true. And so let me explain. In the private equity world, if you look at deal flow, most of the time they convert 1 to 0.5% of the deals they look at. And for them, most of the deals they look at are over $1 million in EBITDAs, which is just a fancy word for profit. I'm not going to get into it. And so they're only able to convert that percentage not because they don't have the money to buy the other 99, but because the other 99 aren't worth buying. And so if you think, as somebody who's never owned a business before, that you're going to outsmart the private equity guys, who still have bazillions of dollars on the sideline and they're still choosing not to get in for the vast majority of these businesses, it's probably because they know something that you don't, which is that many of these businesses aren't sellable. And so there's a key difference, which is that there's a business that can make money. So if I am a videographer and I have two guys who help me edit videos and we run a video development shop, whatever. And let's say we make, you know, $250,000 a year in profit off of, call it $500,000 a year in revenue. Okay, this would be a typical small business that someone might be looking at getting into for $0 down. Now, if I'm getting in for $0 down, then that means me as the videographer main guy who's selling my business, I'm gonna use quotes here, is not gonna get anything to give you this business. Okay, fine. So then what happens? Well, then you have to install an operator in a business that you know nothing about, and you have to be able to attract that operator and see if they're good or not, but you have no idea about anything related to the business, and or you then just take their place, again, knowing less than them about the business. And so you, for $0 down, you get to inherit all of their liabilities, and then they walk away, and then you just bought yourself a job for $0, which is actually how most jobs work. You don't have to pay to get the job. You just get the job. And so it functions basically the same way, except you have a little bit more upside, and you definitely have guaranteed liability when you get into the game. Because if you buy for $0 down, it's usually because you're incurring a debt. So you do something like seller financing, and people talk about that. It's like, oh, and we have these really cool deal structures. I've looked at the vast majority of these deal structures are not nearly as complex as they need to be. It's just like you pay nothing, and off the revenue from the business or the profit from the business that you generate by now taking my job over for me, you can pay me. And so now you work for me. I don't know if that's necessarily something you want to do, but a lot of people get into it not knowing that. Now, sometimes people do even worse and they get in and they pay a check for the business that isn't worth anything either. That's even worse. They're taking out, you know, loans against their retirement accounts, or they're getting SBA loans, or getting something that basically puts them into a lot of risk. Now, again, I'm not going to say that for all people everywhere, getting a business for free is a bad idea. If you know what you're doing, it can be a really profitable way to do it. I just think most people don't, which is why I'm a big advocate of starting businesses. Now, here's another stat that they will throw at you. They'll say 95% of businesses that start fail within 10 years, and businesses that already exist are more likely to continue to exist, which is not a terrible statement to make. But the question is, what percentage of businesses that are purchased continue to exist afterwards? Now, that's that I don't know. But I can promise you, as somebody who has started almost all the businesses that I have and then eventually sold, it takes a lot to know about any business, even if you know business in general, to get into a new game. And so to assume, it's basically just rooted in uninformed optimism, is that you get excited about this thing, you say, how hard could it be? You get into it, and then you realize why the other guy's getting out of it. Because the thing is, and this is the TLDR of this, before I get into the other potential models that you can use. Just because you don't pay money for it doesn't mean it's free. And just because they give you the asset doesn't mean it's worth buying. And so a lot of times you're just inheriting liability on a business that you don't understand much about. And again, the business owner is literally selling you. He's selling the business. So he or she is going to be rose-colored glasses on how easy it is. But there's always the question, which is like, well, maybe Gen Z doesn't want to be a plumber, but Gen Z is probably happy to own an asset that cash flows. Like, people are like, man, all these Gen Z boomers are giving up their apartment buildings because their Gen Z kids don't want to fix toilets. I don't know if that's true. I think that if they have a cash flowing asset, they would just give it to their next of kin. And so if it is truly an asset, it means they have somebody who's running it, it is sellable, guess what? They don't give it to you for free. And so we have these plumbing, HVAC, whatever examples, but you know the average multiples that these guys are getting offered when the real businesses are getting bought, the ones that are functional assets that can be sold, they're getting 10 to 12 times earnings because people are doing roll-ups, which is the ultimate version of this playbook, in order to generate a lot of wealth. Now, on the small side, sometimes they're getting 5 or 6 times earnings, and then when they roll them all together, they get 12, whatever. Waste Management, if you've heard of WM, big, big, big publicly traded company, this is actually how he grew the business, is he just acquired trash routes over and over and over again. And the thing is that he got into that business as a former M&A guy, understood how this was going to work, and crushed it over a very, very, very long period of time. But he knew that business inside and out, and he had a model for how he was going to combine them and operationalize them. So he was an exceptional operator. If you're like, you know what, I'm looking between 6 different businesses and I'm just going to try and get the one that I can get for $0 down, probably not the best bet. And so my big warning flag on this is that most of these businesses are not worth getting into debt for because you're just buying a job and the main source of value is leaving. And then when you take it over, you work for them for the intended duration of the debt that you now owe them for taking over their business and doing their job for them. If you make very little money and the owner makes $200,000 a year from his business, it might make sense for you. If you know that business, you worked in a business that was comparable, you can take it over from the owner, that makes a lot of sense. Like if you're the operator of that business and then you sell or finance it from the owner as he moves out, a ton of sense. But if you're a guy who works as a project manager in an oil company, and then you want to go buy a dry cleaning business that's a local business from an owner that's leaving, and you're picking between that and a lawn care and a car wash, like, can be kind of tough because you have to have a clear vision of what you're going to do to operationalize and improve the business compared to the former owner. And I think sometimes we come in thinking, oh, we're so smart. And they're like, oh yeah, we did that like 2 years ago, it didn't work. And then this is the classic consulting joke, which is, you know, consulting kid at 24 says, oh, you should do X, Y, and Z to the industry executive who's been doing it for 20 years. And they're like, yeah, we tried that. That didn't work. Because we used our second brain cell and realized it would pack these 3 problems. And then it's like, ooh. Yeah, and so ignorance is bliss is what they say until it comes to roost. Meaning until the bills are due, right? And so you have to know how to get customers reliably. You have to know how to sell reliably. You have to know how to hire and train good talent. You need to know where to look. You need to know how to create compensation structures that incentivize the right behavior. You have to know how to like deal with theft. You have to know what to do when the pieces get broken on the equipment. There's a number, you know, you have to know what to do when the accounts don't get paid on time and like what the recoup process is. Like there's all these different things that you have to learn how to do. And if you've never run a business before, on one level you could say, oh, well, I'll just do what they're doing. But I want to be real with you. They're really small. And so you're not going to get a big business for $0 down. I'll just say it right now, unless it's massively distressed, in which case you're getting into a very complex and hairy situation, which is why private equity guys like, there's distressed asset experts, and that's all they do is turnarounds. And if you've literally never been in business before, probably not the first best bet. And so if you're going to then go, okay, well, I'm going on a small business and I'm going to trade on SDE, which is something called seller discretionary earnings, which is basically what the owner pays themselves because they work in the business plus the distributions at the end of the year, then remember that whatever this business owner says they're working, they say, oh, I only work a couple hours a week on it. It's a lie. It's a complete lie. They work all the hours of the day on it. They always do, just like any other entrepreneur does, because it's how they feed themselves and their family. So, yeah. And if you shadow them for a week, it's easy as a business owner to not fix things for a week. Like, you can just basically delay fires. It's like when you fix up your house before you sell it. Like, you fix everything ahead of time, then you put it on the market. And so it's like you kind of buy yourself like 6 months of no problems, and then problems come. And if you don't know how to fix them, you're fucked. And so one of the other things about this opportunity that's so compelling is, like, who doesn't want to get really valuable stuff for free, right? It's just such a compelling narrative, which is why I wanted to make this video, to say not that it's impossible or that you can't do it, but just what are the other sides of this that you might not be seeing? And so when someone, you look at a P&L, right, profit and loss statement, and you see what their net income for the year is or whatever, small businesses are notoriously volatile. And they usually have one primary stream of acquisition, one way to get new customers. And maybe there's one key employee that is the manager of the location that if they left, the whole business is fucked. There's a lot of one-itis in very small businesses. And when you have one-itis, when that one point of failure does fail, which it often does at some point, which is what keeps the business small, the business fails with it. And the failure sometimes isn't acknowledged because you just lose money every month until you run out of money, which sucks. Imagine working 80 hours a week for a month, only get to the end of the month and be poorer than you were when you started the month. This is something that, this is the quote dark side of entrepreneurship that a lot of people don't talk about publicly, which is people are like, everybody should start a business. It's like, well, did you know that when you work as an employee, you get paid? No matter, like, you get paid every week and you work hard and your bank account never goes down unless you have spending problems. It literally always goes up. As an entrepreneur, you can work every hour that you're awake for an entire month and then be poorer at the end of the month. And the vast majority of these seller finance deals are personally guaranteed. As in, it's one of two things. So either they'll demand that you personally guarantee the debt, meaning that you will pay it. Now you take over the asset that makes money, and the hope is that the asset pays off the debt rather than it coming out of your pocketbook. Now, if someone doesn't require that, then what they'll often require is that it's collateralized, meaning it's backed up by the shares in the business. So it's like, you buy the business from them, and then if you don't pay on the debt, you have to give the business back. But most times for these business owners, it's going to be personally guaranteed. One other scenario where the $0 down works is like the waste management scenario. So let's say that you are very good at running your video agency. Well, if you go acquire another video agency, then you already have the infrastructure, and you're really just like merging them into your infrastructure that already exists. Those types of deals can be incredibly lucrative because you already have probably superior processes to the one that you're acquiring. They might have a couple of key talented people that you're trying to bring in. This is sometimes called an acqui-hire, where you write the check, check to the founder for a little bit, or you give them a tiny slice of equity in your company in order to bring their company into the fold. And as long as the net end thing is worth more, your slice is worth more than it was before, it doesn't matter if it dilutes. And so this is a really common strategy for growing inorganically, which means you grow through acquisition of other businesses, rather than organic growth, which means that you just sell more customers or make them worth more. And so this is a very viable strategy for growing businesses, but I think the key point is that using it to get into business, really tough. Using it to expand business is significantly easier, or at least not necessarily easier, you're just better at this point. I think there's a couple of alternative models that work, I think, more well. One is understanding the multiples arbitrage, which is really being in the M&A or private equity game more than being in the I want to buy a business for myself to make money game and have like a portfolio of small businesses. It's far more lucrative to think, okay, I looked at all these different types of businesses. I think this is the type of dry cleaning thing I'm going after. This is the type of lawn care thing I'm going after. These are the four things that the best ones do that not everyone's doing. And that's going to be my quote playbook for value add. So you have a value add of like, how I'm going to make this thing more profitable. But then on top of that, you think, okay, I'm only going to get 10 of these things and I'm going to rope them all together. And a deal that makes a lot of sense for everybody is saying, hey, owner, currently your business is for sale for 3x. If you can wait 12 to 18 months, we can sell them all together for 8x. And I'm asking for 2 or 3x on that, and you get the rest. So you still double the value of your thing, you keep working in it, and I'm gonna put the deal together. Obviously, this is a different skill set, but you allow them to continue taking the operational risk of the business, and there's things where you can get options in the business in order to do that. You say, hey, I wanna sign an option today where I get 100% control. I'll give you a fraction of the amount of money today to get 100% control of the business. You keep running it, but I am allowed to sell it for the next 18 to 24 months, and I have complete rights there, and you have rights up to this amount of money, and then I get everything after that, right? That would be a sample way of making something like this work where you don't incur as much risk, and it is a true transaction, and it's niched down in a way that you're only focus on businesses that you've done a lot of research on that you can provide disproportionate value to. I think the idea of having seven small businesses that are all different is a farce for the most part that is peddled by people who profit more from selling it to you. Just being really real. Because if one of those businesses made more money, then you would just target only that business. Like, this is just like if your business is the portfolio business, then your customer that you're selling or that you're buying becomes the individual business. And so then, again, you look at what business you do the best with that you understand the best, and then you say, you know what, screw these other six, I'm just going to focus on that. So you end up getting to the strategy that I just said. So I know about this whole buying a business for $0 down and selling a business for $0 down because I've been on both sides of it. And I sold one of my five gyms that I ended up selling. I had six. I shut one down. I sold one for $0 upfront, but seller financed. And then the other four I sold for cash upfront with no payment plans. So this particular one I sold to a customer of the gym. And so you think, okay, well, this person was in the gym all the time. They really liked it. They'd been with me for a few years. So like all that stuff, right? Now, we ended up, I think, deciding on one times earnings or something like that in terms of the business. I just sold it for 1x for that particular one. And I think I spread it over 2 years. So it's like they could have a little bit of decrease because I didn't think they were going to be as good as I was at running the gym. And as soon as I handed it to them, like, that was it. I also offered to do a service period where they could just pay me for the marketing, where I would just run the ads for them and do the creative. And they would just pay me like a normal, you know, fee per month just for doing the work. And so I did that for the first 6 months until we got a vendor in that could take it over after that. And so I've seen both sides of this, and I was grateful to have given the gym up so that I could pursue the turnaround business and do gym launch and the things that ultimately became really big. So the key point is that the customer who bought it took over running the gym. They became a manager. And so they became the small business owner. And so it's one of those things where it's like, if you want to get into the business, which this particular person loved the gym, they loved the people, they worked out there all the time. They're like, I spend half my day here anyways. So it made sense because they wanted to be in the business. If you're trying to buy this as an asset and don't expect to be in the business all the time, I think you're going to be rudely awakened. And that's really what I'm trying to hit at is, like, most of the time, the only businesses you're going to get for $0 down are businesses that you've just bought a job in. Because anything that is truly sellable, there's enough money out there for people who want to buy sellable businesses, and they will just get a check for it. So a different model that gets pushed a lot is consulting for equity. And this one also seems very attractive, but let's talk about equity really quickly in general to be like, why do I even want equity? So equity comes with lots of stuff, but there's three main ones. One is decision-making power, which is who gets to make the calls in the business. The second is distribution. So when there's profit, who gets it? And then third is that there's upon sale or exit, there's a value of the business that gets paid to the owners or the shareholders, right? So that's the three main benefits of equity. And all of these things you can actually contract out in terms independent from actually owning equity to begin with. And so if you want to, quote, consult for equity, the question that I ask is, what problem are we solving? So typically it's you want to have some sort of permanent payment for one-time work. But I can tell you that most people who are on the receiving end of that don't like making recurring payments on one-time work. And I have done consulting for equity deals, and I do not like them, and I do no longer do them. I have not done it for a long time. And let me explain why. If it's a small business, small businesses are volatile by nature. And it's the reason that a lot of marketing agencies that sell to small businesses don't ask for necessarily a percentage of the business. They just ask to get paid every month. And so because the cash flow is the thing that, like at the end of the month, unless it's being well operated, a lot of small businesses don't make money. They're very volatile. And so all of a sudden you're like, great, I have 20% of something that didn't make any money last month and I work. Well, that kind of sucks, right? Of course. And so you're getting value, you're getting 20% ownership in an exit that'll probably never come or be at a high valuation for a small business. You're getting distributions that are very volatile. But then, of course, yay, you make all the decisions. Congratulations, you bought yourself a job. So consulting for equity has that kind of at the first layer of problems. The second layer of problems is that if you succeed in transferring your knowledge to the business, then they no longer need you. And like I said, people don't like paying for things that they don't need. And this happens between partners as well. This isn't just from an outside consultant perspective. If you start a business with somebody and you say, hey, I'm only going to work for a year, and then after that, I just want to keep getting paid, it's tough. A lot of people don't like that. And so if that is the game you're going to play, then I would say, number one, have a clear exit clause of like, this is what I will get paid on an exit at any point if you want to buy me out. The second way of doing that is something called a shotgun clause, which is like if any partner proposes to buy the other partner out, the other partner has the ability to buy at that same rate. So if we're 50-50 partners, for example, and let's say I say, hey, I will give you $100,000 for your half of the business, you're allowed to immediately take that $100,000, and if you can procure it, buy my 50%. And that keeps the ask at a true fair market rate, because whatever you'd offer to buy, you have to be comfortable selling at, because the person could flip it on you and buy it from you. So it's a second clause that you can do, or you can just have a flat amount and just say you agree upon this amount today, or you can say it's this multiple of trailing 12 months upon an exit that they can just choose to pay you. And then you say, how do you want that to be paid? Which is another whole set of issues. Like, do you want them to be seller financed over time? Do you want them to take on debt in the business? Does that need to be cash? All these things are negotiable, but it's good to think about that stuff ahead of time. But fundamentally, the reason that I don't like consulting is that for equity is that people will resent you. Like, people don't like paying for stuff when you don't work. It just is what it, like, they just don't like it, in my experience. Even if you, like, I mean, it's unfortunate, but if you say, hey, listen, you know, there's going to be a time in the future where you're sending me a check for $500,000 every month if we pull this off, and then they're going to say, oh, I don't care. If I'm sending you $500,000 a month, then I'm making, you know, $1 million a month. Well, when the person actually has to write the $500,000 check every month, they don't feel that way. I promise you. I've been on the other side of this. So how do you do this the quote right way? So one is you can have all those exit clauses that I said earlier. That's if you insist on doing equity. The other version of this is that you don't do equity and you just get paid a fee for your services, which when they no longer want those services, that's it. And I mean, think about it this way. If you get them to commit to a year and they don't want to stick with that contract, then what makes you think that they're going to want to stick with an equity contract? Like, you're still squeezing blood from a stone. Are you going to go through lawyers and a lawsuit and arbitration? It takes, you know, a year, 2 years for these things to come to do. Like, it's just, and the business that you're probably doing this with are tiny. It's just not worth it for either of you. So I think most of the time people want, they just want permanence to something that is impermanent. So just change the business model that you have if you really want to do that. So that's thing one. Thing two is, what is the right way to do this? I think ongoing work for ongoing payment makes sense. And so it's, instead of thinking about it as a consulting relationship, think about it as a service for equity relationship. So if I am a marketing agency and I have a really dialed in process, then I say, hey, I'm going to be your marketing department, which would normally be 20% of your payroll. And I'm now 20% of the business and I have this function and I will continue to exercise this function for the business. That makes sense. If you've got a content agency or something like that, like, that makes sense. It's because they pay every month because you do work every month. Now, the clauses that you would want to negotiate around that on either side is, what does good work look like? And on what timelines do we expect things from? The same way you'd have a statement of work from somebody who'd be a vendor, you just do that with a partner, but it works the same way. And so fundamentally, people want recurring payments but don't want recurring work. And in my experience, the only way to get around that, here's the kicker, the only way to get around that is to take on risk. And so you take on risk in one of two ways. You either you start the business with the person at day one, in which case you have taken on risk for doing that, you front your time, things like that, in the beginning. It's very different from going into a business that's already established and making money. The second way is that you write a check. You compensate someone for the risk that they took. Now, if you write a check for 10%, you have given consideration for what you're getting. Now, at that point, that's up to you. Now, if you say, hey, I want to be an advisor, and I think I can help you grow this business, but it's not super valuable today, and then you write a check for what its current value is, and you can help improve it, then that's fine. And so the thing is, if you're trying to get in these small businesses that aren't very valuable, the benefit of them not being very valuable is that it's not very expensive to buy in. But there's a real exchange that occurs. And I think fundamentally in my experience, like, we write checks. We only write checks at acquisition.com. And it's because, I'll give you a story to illustrate this point. So we have a company in our portfolio where when we were doing diligence, I was like, I'm going to murder it for this business. Like, I knew that I could change their sales process and I felt very confident that I could 3 to 5x LTV. Like, very confident. And so we bought the business and, you know, the team did all the diligence and broke down all the things that we were going to do in all the departments. And I spent 4 hours looking at the sales process. That's all I did. Rewrote the script, rewrote the process, remade the price points and packages and said, this is what we're selling. And after I explained it to the founders, they were like, this is the most valuable call I've ever been on. And I was like, that's awesome. And so now all we need to do is roll it out to a zillion locations and my work is done. Now, if I had done that and it was just a quote consulting fee, it doesn't matter how much value you say you're going to provide. It's very tough for someone to write you a $10 million check for 4 hours. Now, there are probably some businesses that will do that. But if a business isn't even that size, but you make someone that much money, still very hard to enforce. It's very unlikely that they're going to pay that. So I bought a huge chunk of the business before doing this because I knew what value I was going to bring. Now, after that point, I own my chunk. I already wrote a check for it. You know what I mean? Like it's done, right? And then at that point, if I'm not me personally working on that thing, and most of it right now is my team just running the implementation, right? Making sure that it's getting scaled out, hiring people, doing all that stuff. Like that stuff is all required. But in terms of me as the equity holder in the business, less time. Also, mind you, I have a big team of people that run the portfolio companies and interact with them specifically so that we can continue to grow them at a faster rate than they'd grow on their own. I said there was three things that you can get. You have the decision-making power, you have the exit money that you get upon an exit, and then you've got distributions. And so the distributions can be done a number of ways, right? So one is you can just get a forced distribution off of profit at the end of the month. You can do those quarterly. You can also just have a set fee. You basically give yourself a job in the company. And so you say, hey, I'm going to be a W-2 employee of this business, or I'm a contractor with a guaranteed contract. Those are other ways that you can get it. Those are both guaranteed payments compared to profit. So as a just different consideration, they're also taxed differently. Another way is that you can get a royalty or a rev share off of top line. You can also do that above a baseline. So you say, hey, you guys are at 100K a month. Everything above 100K, I get 20% off, something like that. There are a number of different ways that you can structure this in order to get paid, because especially if you don't have decision-making power, that first one, then someone can run up the bill on the profit and run their personal expenses through the business. And if you don't have decision-making power, they can basically eliminate the profit of the business if they so choose. Now, obviously, you hope that someone doesn't do that. You put other clauses in place to, you know, control spending, blah, blah, blah. But the other three that I just mentioned, being a 1099, being a W-2, or doing some sort of rev share, all of those are things that you can use to kind of protect yourself in a minority position to make sure that you're still getting distributions from a business that you're working with. And for very small businesses, I'd recommend a rev share over a profit share because, one, you don't want to check their financials every month. That's a pain in the butt. It's much easier to say, like, okay, what was revenue? Cool, this percent of it is mine, or this percent above X is mine. But you're going to run into the same issues with a rev share as any kind of service agreement because they're going to have to send you a check every month. Now, I do like the employee version of this, the W-2 or the 1099 version of this. You come on as a consultant that's paid, which is a 1099 contractor, and you have a, you know, you're on payroll, right? And that I tend to like. It feels a little bit more permanent. It's more consistent. Someone doesn't have to manually calculate your check every month, which I personally prefer. And so those are different ways that you can structure a consulting for equity model. But by and large, just putting $0 in and getting equity for one-time work is tough. And so I think that on a longer time horizon, those things usually blow up in your face. So either have a very clear exit or have alternative means of getting compensated. Because most of these businesses aren't valuable at the exit, which means you really only want permanent cash flow, and there's other ways to do it besides equity. So I alluded to three models at the very beginning of the video. One is just, you know, $0 down buying. Another is, you know, consulting for equity. The difference between those two is just one is majority, the other is minority, right? Typically, consulting for equity is more of an advisor relationship. You're getting between, you know, 1 or 2%, depending on the side of the business, all the way up to sometimes 20-ish percent, 30% of the business if it's really small or really volatile or you have a really good track record, whatever. The $0 down, you usually buy the whole business or 80% or more. The third model is service for equity. And I like this one the best because you are doing recurring work for recurring payment. And so now you're basically doing a core function of the business. This is a partnership. You do something that you're good at, they do something they're good at, and you have efficiencies and so do they. And then there's a symbiotic relationship between both businesses that function. You both have permanent interest in the outcome of the individual business. I like this a lot because it's just very clear what the deliverable is and you can really structure it like a statement of work. And the pricing of the equity is very clear because you can just go market rate on what your services would be against what the value of the business is. So you have to agree on both of those things. But if you know what your value of your rates are and you know what you want to value the business is and you agree on that, then you can have a simple calculation for how much that money getting paid towards that is worth. And so one thing my team wanted me to double click on, when you're in a buying process, it's very different than from a consulting process. All right, so this is again, this is the big difference and it feels very different. Like I've done both. consulting for equity feels like a sale. Like you're getting someone to agree to like give you something now for something that you're going to do later, right? When you buy, it's a completely different experience. You're like, these are all the risks of the business. These are the things that I think could go down. These are the things that I think could go up. But the few special tricks that you're going to apply to the business, I don't share those until after I buy. And I have made the mistake of giving all of that stuff specific to the business ahead of time and then them backing out of a deal and using all that stuff and then profiting a shitload of money. And so I'm usually not the person to say, like, hold back. But there's a difference between like making content publicly and having a very personalized, implementable solution in exactly how you're going to do it for somebody, and then saying, yeah, let's do this thing so that I can do that, when you've pretty much already spelled out the entire process of what you're going to do, right? And so I've made that mistake. And so I save, like if I know I'm going to 10x the business, then I'm just going to be willing to pay more for it. So it's going to come into how my confidence in the purchase more than how I'm going to sell them, right? That's fundamental. Like the difference is that when you're, okay, the difference is when you're consulting for equity, you're selling. When you're writing checks, you're buying. That's the difference. And I don't want to buy with a baked-in value add that I'm about to add. Like, I don't want to have to pay a premium because I'm good at growing businesses. That makes no sense, right? I want to pay at a discount because I know that the remaining equity for the founder is going to be worth 10 times more if I get involved in it. But I don't want to pay that. I don't want to have that factored in. I don't want to have the after value add factored in the price I pay, because now I got to do the value add just to break even on my initial buy-in. So that's why I approach the business for what it currently is, and I value the business on what it currently does and what it is expected to do without me, because that's fundamentally what I'm buying. Now, I then know what I want to do, but there's always operational risk. There's always execution risk. There's things they might not sign off on. It might take longer than I expect, which happens all the time. All of these things occur, but are important in how you buy if you want to get into that game. So one of the best things to do if you're looking for skeleton in the closet in a business to say like, hey, is this really what I think it is do 360 interviews. And so you want to interview, sure, the business owner, but you also want to interview their team. And I basically want to cross-check stories. And this is where the real kicker is we ask everybody to do a time study, everyone in leadership. And so if you have the anecdotal feedback of what they say they're doing, and then you get the time-based feedback of what they're actually doing, or at least report what they're doing, that's two separate pieces of data from every single person, and you can paint a pretty good picture of what's actually happening versus what they say is happening within the business by basically cross-referencing both of those sources. The skeletons that you find when you look into this stuff honestly varies by business. So in some businesses, the founder is completely aloof, which sometimes is a great thing, because then you're like, oh, okay, this is not a lot of risk when this person leaves, because clearly this is the real operator. They're just being underpaid or undertitled. That's a great scenario. You want that type of scenario. There's the other, you know, more common scenario, which is that, oh, the founder's obsessed. He works around the clock and he micromanages all of our stuff. And I'm like, yeah, okay, so this guy works 3 hours a week, sure. You know what I mean? And so you really find out more. It's like, wait, where does the founder spend all his time? All of his time's in marketing. Like, ooh, is that something I'm good at? If I'm not good at that, then it's like, oh, he spends all of his time fixing cars. Like if, let's say it's a mechanic shop. You're like, well, shoot, I don't know anything about that. And if he leaves and I can't train the staff and I don't know how to fix stuff, and then what's going to happen? Our reputation goes down, blah, blah, blah. And so the biggest thing that I want to know in a business is where they're allocating their resources. And so the resources, especially in a small business, is oftentimes human capital, which is how much you're paying per hour for the people. And so I want to see where those dollars are going, because that'll show me where the bottlenecks are in the business, where money is being misappropriated or misallocated, as in it's going somewhere that it's not getting a good return. Or there's a place where it's getting a ton of investment. I'm like, wait, no one's even mentioned this, but all the employees are spending more than a quarter of their time on this one thing. I needed to learn more about this. So what you do with the time studies, you give someone an Excel sheet. They mark out 15-minute increments on their calendar, Monday through Friday or Monday through Saturday, whatever days they work. And every 15 minutes, you have them set an alarm and they fill it in. Now, you'll also be able to see that when people do this and don't actually follow instructions, they'll just write the same thing for like 7 blocks in a row, and they'll have another thing 7 blocks in a row, because they didn't follow instructions. The people who follow instructions, they're literally have like different things every 15 minutes, because most of us actually do change tasks a lot throughout the day. And so I also promise you, anybody who bitches and moans about following this, one, it's going to be tough to implement change in general. Like if they can't do a one-time time study, then good luck with your new sales and marketing initiative. But in terms of the actual doing this, I have done many time studies in my life, and I am always the most productive on the weeks that I do them. Like I always tell myself I'm going to do them forever and then I never do. But you can tell that to the team or to the founder, like, you think that this will take you time, it will take you no extra time because it's literally an alarm. You write down what you did and then you go back to it. But you're so productive because you know you're against, it's like being against the clock the entire week. And so that's just a hack. And I'm just telling you, like, you'll get more done in that week than you've ever done in your life. So you can probably like discount the productivity of the entire team by like 50%. But it does make everyone look good. So big picture, if you want to get into business, I think the best way to get into business is just get into business and just get into a business that doesn't cost a lot of money to start. That's why, you know, we invested in school, which is, you know, the easiest way that I know to get people to make their first dollar online. Right now, more than one out of two people, so 54.1% of people who start a paid community make their first dollar online, which I'm fucking stoked about. But there's a number of other businesses. All service-based businesses are businesses that you can start for $0 down. Like, you just sell your time, and then over time, you bring other people in, you document processes, and then you create a business around it. And so these are things that cost no money to start and pretty much always have baked in margin, because if you are making money in a service business, you let go of headcount. That's just kind of how it works. And so just giving you the real reality of it. And if you have experience in an industry, that's where I think the $0 down thing makes a ton of sense. So $0 down, if you have a ton of industry experience and or are taking over a business that you have already worked in, makes a lot of sense. You know where the skeletons are. If you have a specific skill set, rather than doing consulting for equity, I would consider doing service for equity or doing a consulting for equity deal that might not necessarily be equity. It might be just consulting for a rev share or consulting for maybe a bonus at a sale. Those are a little bit easier to negotiate in than the equity piece. It's also not taxable, which is nice as well, or at least getting a... I won't get into deal structure stuff, but like there's ways of structuring it so you don't have to pay taxes for getting the equity. So a lot of you guys are looking for shortcuts to get your first business started. I made a whole video about the biggest advantage when you're starting out, which is called Do the Unscalable. You'll want to check out that video. It will help you make more money faster.